We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us this morning. In this hour of Focus, we will revisit a subject that certainly we have talked about before and has been much discussed over the last couple of years, and that is subprime lending, the foreclosure crisis that we have seen play out across the United States, what that was about, who was affected, and why. And we have this morning a scholar here on the program who has done a lot of research on this subject. We'll be talking with Jeff Crump. He is associate professor in the Housing Studies program at the University of Minnesota in their College of Design. And he's done a lot of research on issues of affordable housing, housing policy, urban politics. And he's here on the campus to give a talk in the Friday Forum series. This is a series of noontime talks that has been going on for a long time at the University Y on the U of I campus. And the theme overall for this fall series is deconstructing, reconstructing the American dream. And certainly one thing that has always been a part of the American dream has been home ownership. So we'll talk about the future of the idea of home ownership. That's one thing that we'll be talking about. And also trying to ask again some of the basic questions about this financial crisis that people continue to ask, and that is, why did this happen? And should the government have addressed this, or how do we address it in future? That's the idea. Enough certainly to keep us talking for at least an hour. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. So if you'd like to be in on the conversation, that's the number to use if you're local. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And callers are invited, and I certainly hope people will stay focused on the topic and will be as brief as they can. That will help us get in as many callers as possible. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, David.
I want to talk a little bit about sort of where we are. I think some of the most recent numbers on foreclosures, for example, that I have come across, these come from the realty industry. They said that in August, that lenders foreclosed on more than 95,000 properties, and that was the highest monthly total since May of 2005, so more than 5 years. And that's when they first started, when this company, Realty Track, first started to collect this data. So it's a crisis is not over, and apparently there are some people who think that next year could be even worse. What do you think about where we are now and where we're going?
Well, we're in a situation that's really serious for many borrowers in the country. One of the more recent figures that really struck me from the Harvard State of the Nation's Housing Report 2010 was that the ratio of debt to equity is at 163%. And what that means is that right now borrowers owe 63% more than their homes are worth on a collective basis. And so home values have fallen much more rapidly than mortgage debt has fallen. If the value of your house goes down, that doesn't mean that the principal amount of your mortgage is going to go down. And so a relatively high proportion of people are underwater on their homes, which what we mean by that is that they owe more than their homes could be sold for.
Right.
And so I think many people are in a very serious situation financially because of that. The numbers of foreclosures probably will keep going up. And, of course, one of the latest things to happen is the finding that many lenders and servicers have been submitting fraudulent documents along with their foreclosures, especially in the 23 states that are judicial foreclosure states. Illinois is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So in many these states right now, foreclosures coming to a halt because they were signing documents testifying that they know who owns the note on the house and what the borrower owes. And they were signing thousands of these documents and then getting them notarized illegally. So many of the large lenders are freezing their foreclosures right now in these 23 judicial foreclosure states. But that's a very complicated issue, and it may slow it down for a little while, but yeah. We don't know what's going to happen.
And I think we've seen some of the first lawsuits on this being filed, and no doubt this is something that is going to keep courts and lawyers and people tied up for who knows how many years to come.
Yeah, it will take a very long time to sort out. And for example, if you've bought a house that was foreclosed on, you may not actually have clear title to that house if it was illegally foreclosed upon.
Mm-hmm. Then, though, wouldn't there be questions about who exactly does have clear title to the house?
Well, this is is an important question, and it seems strange, but because home loans were bundled together, sold as securities, sold and resold as securities, that actually tracking who owns your mortgage on your house and has the right to foreclose is not easy to do.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about this before. It's been much discussed. The basic question, well, how exactly did this happen? And while the misfeasance, malfeasance, law-breaking by lenders seems to become more obvious, people have made that argument all along. It also seems that people continue, though, to want to say that the responsibility, maybe not all the responsibility, but a lot of the responsibility lies with the borrowers, and that we have people who signed on to a loan that they couldn't afford, and either that they did it knowing that they couldn't afford it, or kidded themselves about whether or not they could afford it, and that a lot of this is a problem with individuals just simply being irresponsible and signing onto something that they really shouldn't have.
Well, if that were true, that would mean that millions of borrowers all of a sudden became irresponsible at the same time, and that just really doesn't hold water. I think when we look at the mortgage process, there are people who are underwriters, and their job is to make sure that the loans that they make are viable loans in the sense that the borrowers can pay those loans. And so that used to include examining the borrower's income, their employment history, and so on. And that all went by the wayside in the housing boom. And so what we have are people being made loans that they couldn't possibly pay. Part of the reason for that is the way people are compensated in that industry, and it's all in the fees. They made money on originating the loans, knowing that they were then going to sell the loans up in the securities market, and if the loan went bad, it didn't really matter. And they had a vested interest in the loans going bad in the sense every time a borrower would have to refinance, you'd make another set of fees. So that was a very lucrative structure as long as home prices kept going up and people could refinance.
Yeah. One other point, and we have a couple of callers here I want to go to that I think that you have made in some of the writings you've done about this is that actually if you take a look at a lot of the people who got caught up in this, people who had these subprime loans, that in fact they could have qualified for loans that, if not conventional, at least would have been much more advantageous to them than the loans that they ended up signing.
Yeah, it's estimated that about 50% of the people who got subprime loans had a credit score that would have qualified them for a prime loan. Mm-hmm. But the structure is that they don't say, well, we could sell you a cheaper loan. they were more highly compensated. The more expensive the loan to the consumer, the more highly compensated the mortgage brokers were. And it was just a few weeks ago that the Federal Reserve finally outlawed what are called yield spread premiums. And this is the structure that rewards mortgage brokers for giving loans that are more expensive.
Our guest in this hour of the program is Jeff Crump. He's associate professor in the Housing Studies Program. This is in the Department of Design, Housing, and Apparel at the University. Have I got all that?
Yeah, you do.
at the University of Minnesota. And he's here visiting Champaign-Urbana. He's going to give a talk in the Friday Forum series today. Also, he'll be speaking at a geography colloquium a little bit later today. So the Department of Geography, one of the sponsors of his visit here. And we have several people who would like to get in on the conversation. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have several callers. We'll take them in the order they came in, 1, 2, 3. So we'll start with line number one in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
My question is, why aren't people from Moody's and S&P in jail for overrating those packaged subprime mortgage instruments, you know, whatever you want to call them, the derivatives or CDOs or whatever name they came up with? I mean, they overrated them so bad it was ridiculous.
I don't have an answer for that one. I think there has been a lot of attention paid to the credit rating industry that rated what are essentially junk mortgages as AAA securities.
Well, I mean, is anybody looking into this or going to do anything about it, or is just forget about it?
It's up in the air right now. There are congressional hearings that have address the mortgage rating industry, or the credit rating industry, I should say. But it's not clear what's going to happen in terms of enforcement and in terms of regulation into the future.
Well, okay, thank you.
All right, line number two. This is also Champaign. Hello.
Hi. First of all, I think one of the big problems is that we're not looking at the culpability of the market, and everybody was getting rewarded, getting bonuses for the number of mortgages that they sold and the price of the mortgages. And this is not just your frontline guy who's selling a mortgage to an individual homeowner or wannabe homeowner, but it's also the people who are 3, 4, 5 steps above that. That's one issue. The other issue that I have not heard anybody address, which just drives me crazy, when my wife and I bought our first home 16 years ago, we got pressured heavily by both the realtor and by our bank to buy a mortgage that was clearly not in our price range. You know, we could buy the house, but that wouldn't mean we'd be able to also afford utilities, gas, power, water, and things you want to put in your home, like furniture and such. And I think that's one of the things that nobody's talked about. The industry is pushing people to buy the shack, but they're not thinking about what people need to be able to afford to fill the shack. And I'd like to hear a little commentary about that. Thank you.
All right.
Well, I think you're right in a lot of ways. One of the issues that went on in the boom was that mortgage companies stopped keeping escrow accounts. And those are the accounts that you pay into to cover the taxes and insurance on your home. And it used to be that the lenders really wanted you to have that because they want you to have home insurance because the home is their security and you got to pay your property taxes. But one way they qualified people and gave them an unrealistic monthly payment is by not adding in the cost of insurance and taxes into people's monthly payments and keeping those escrow accounts. So they just did away with that, and then that made people more vulnerable to other things too.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to hear the comments of the caller. I think my wife and I, when we applied for our mortgage now more than 20 years ago, had very much the same experience. And so this was long before the problems that we're talking about, where the lender said, well, you can afford to borrow X amount of dollars. And we thought, well, maybe you think so, but we don't. And we thought that was just
be a big mistake to make that kind of commitment. So that makes me wonder whether historically within the lending industry there was this tendency to tell people they could afford to borrow more than perhaps it would have been prudent to do.
Well, part of it relates to the mindset that people were told that house prices could never go down.
Right.
So people would say, well, I may be kind of over my head right now, but in 5 years this place is going to be worth so much more, it's not going to matter. And that was never true in the first place, that home prices have never gone down or could not go down. And we certainly see we're in a declining market now.
Line three. This is Champagne. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
There's been the comment that homes are used as an ATM. In other words, you know, in terms of you just get the second mortgage or whatever, in terms of taking the money, you know, because it was increasing, you were taking it out. Do you know what percentage of that, in terms of the ones that are having difficulty now, is that still a small percentage or what? Do you have any idea?
I don't have that figure on the top of my head, but I can say that there was trillions of dollars taken out of homes through the refinancing process. People sometimes use the money for health care costs. They might use it for education costs, and they also used it for consumption. And part of that relates back to tax policy, which is you can deduct the interest on your taxes for your home mortgage. So people would refi their house and then use that money for maybe other purposes, but then they'd get a tax benefit for that too.
Well, that also was the case too. It didn't seem years ago that you could do it for your credit card or something, wasn't it, or not? A long time ago. If it was for certain items or some or other, I don't know. Another one that was mentioned was the what about the impact on the poor? They really took the real beating on this thing, right?
That's for sure. The initial phase of the subprime lending boom targeted minority communities for those loan products. And those are the first communities that suffer from the foreclosure crisis, and they're still the worst hit communities, yes.
Yeah. And that's something that I know you have done spent a particular amount of time studying, and particularly where you are from in Minneapolis, St. Paul, about how this has affected the low-income areas and about how in neighborhoods like that, that's where there were a lot of these loans. That's also where there are a lot of foreclosures.
Yeah, that's certain. In Minneapolis, I started out by mapping the subprime loans in 2002 and then mapped the foreclosures. And even at that time, the geography of foreclosure really matched the geography of subprime lending. In other words, mm-hmm. The foreclosure crisis in those communities is already beginning 5-6 years ago. And really, the number of foreclosures in minority communities in the Twin Cities, but in other cities as well, there's nothing different about Twin Cities, have been very hard hit by the foreclosure crisis, Cleveland in particular, Baltimore, but Chicago. So these were places where loans were marketed heavily.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very striking because I think that as a nation and perhaps and you talk about the national media, this is something that we really started to pay attention to maybe in, 2007. Was anybody really paying attention to what should have been obvious warning signs here now, we're saying 5 years before that?
I think they should have paid attention, and I really was just following my data. And I said, you're going to have a foreclosure crisis if you don't start regulating some of these risky loan products. But I was literally booed off the stage. And there was so much discussion about how this was opening the doors of opportunity and promoting home ownership that you just really couldn't overcome that. And dealing with race and housing, too, is always a hot-button topic. But really, I was just following the data. And so it's been an interesting research experience, yeah.
Well, here that gets at another issue. And it gets us into talking about the role that the government has played here. And that some people indeed say that part of the problem is that the government decided that it was a good thing for people to own homes and that we should do everything we can to encourage that. and that home ownership is something that, that can be and should be affordable for a wide range of people. So that if, as a matter of policy, we said, we think it's good for people to have homes, and you know, people on the lower end of the income scale shouldn't be closed out of the market. Was that a mistake?
Well, what we did is we coupled the notion that home ownership is for everybody with a deregulated mortgage market. And so somehow lower income people were supposed to be able to afford housing through high cost mortgages. And one thing that's important to remember is that the large majority of money that went into these subprime loans came from the private sector. These are private sector investments via Wall Street and the flow of money down into neighborhoods. 80 or 90% of those loans did not fall under the Community Reinvestment Act because most of the loans are made by non-depository lenders, for example, like Countrywide. Mm-hmm. They are mortgage banks. They don't take deposits from consumers. And so a law like Community Reinvestment Act really only applies to depository lenders, like you and I put our savings or I have our checking accounts in there. So CRA is not responsible for that. But deregulation of the mortgage market has a lot to do with it. And policymakers at the Federal Reserve, there was a debate about do we regulate these risky mortgage products? And they did not regulate risky mortgage products, even though there was a lot of evidence that these were exposing borrowers to undue risk.
Yeah. And it's I think that it's always been the case that people who originate mortgages, they don't keep them all. They sell them off, and so they whatever risk is involved, they pass it on to somebody else. Well, I think here this was even to an even greater extent. Here we had the people who were originating the loans very quickly were getting rid of them, so they had essentially no risk.
That's right. The risk gets passed up through the chain of securitization, but it also sits in the laps of the borrowers and the people in our neighborhoods who have loan products that they can barely afford that have arms that are going to reset, loan products that expose people to multiple risks. And one of the things I found in my work is that what happens is that if somebody gets sick, if they lose their job, if anything happens, then they're not able to make their mortgage payments very quickly because they're already in a precarious situation.
Yeah. Who here again? It just gets us to the question of the role of the government here. Who should have been? Is there someone who or some agency who should have been looking out over the, after the interests of borrowers?
Well, there's no actual agency that's in charge of that. The Federal Reserve can regulate mortgage products to a certain degree. And then there's the SEC too. I'm not an expert at high-level regulation. And now we have, and there is going to be formed a consumer protection agency, which I think I would hope will help oversee some of these products and the fine print in them.
Yeah, that's. I think the idea was to have we have this thing called the Consumer Product Safety Commission. That their idea is that they're supposed to be looking out after the interest of consumers and trying to make sure that they're not products that are offered for sale are indeed safe. And now we have an institution that's kind of a parallel institution that has been created that's supposed to look out for people in terms of their financial life. And I guess it remains to be seen just what this is going to mean.
Yeah, we don't know. But one of the points I like to make is that aside from the financial value of housing, that adequate and affordable housing is essential to human well-being. And so housing is something that we all need from our physical selves, from our social life, from our community life, as well as being an investment. And so I think that's really one reason to focus especially on housing, because becoming homeless is a very serious problem for people. Housing is an interesting commodity in the sense that it's really essential to our human well-being.
Well, and I think that a lot of people would argue that we do indeed have a housing crisis in this country. We maybe have more than one housing crisis. And one is that we have a serious lack of affordable housing, particularly people who, for whatever reason, are renters, and particularly for people who, for low-income families, particularly that kind of housing, quality, affordable housing for low-income families, it's very difficult.
It's been an ongoing problem, and a third of the people in the U.S., or a third of the households, I should say, have been renters all along. And so there's always been a need for good rental housing. And the bottom line with affordable housing is that we demolish more affordable units than we build. And we've been doing this for the last 30 years. And so the shortage of affordable housing is solely because we are eliminating affordable housing.
And just, again, I'm going back to the phones here in a moment, but does all of this call into question or forces us to question the very notion of home ownership?
That's a good question. I think we're almost on unknown territory in terms of home ownership. I think at certain times, in certain places, it has benefited people. The suburban boom benefited white Americans because they were the only ones that could get home loans at that time. But it does call into question whether our model of home ownership is sustainable. And there's other models out there, for example, community land trust models, co-ops. So there are alternatives out there, and I'm hoping we'll get to explore those a bit.
We are at our midpoint here. Our guest is Jeff Crump. He is associate professor in the Housing Studies program at the University of Minnesota in their College of Design. He does research on subjects that include affordable housing and housing policy and urban politics. He's visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to give a talk as part of the Friday Forum series. That's today at noon at the University of Y on the U of I campus. These programs have been going on now for a long time, for many years. They're all free and open to the public. Anybody who is interested in stopping by and hearing what he has to say should certainly feel welcome. And we are here talking about the issue of housing, the mortgage crisis, what that means for home ownership in the United States. Questions are welcome. We have a couple, and we'll get right to them. And maybe I'll just give the numbers again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Another Champaign caller. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, I read an article, I believe this morning or maybe yesterday, that some study had reflected or had shown that racially predatory lending was the major culprit that fueled the housing crisis that we are currently in. And I noticed you did say that minorities, including African Americans, were steered to subprime loans at a disproportionately high rate, and some even that qualified or had the same credit profile as white Americans were nevertheless steered to subprime mortgages. So there is a racial context here, which makes it probably forbidden territory to talk about. But my question is this. When you listen to the right-wing media, including that right-wing media that has strong roots in this community, and Fox News and things of that ilk, they always talk about the Community Reinvestment Act, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and poor borrowers getting over their heads in loans they could not afford as the culprits. They never talk about Wall Street firms, banks, and things of that ilk. Who are they being fair, or are they being typically what right-wing media is in this day and time? Could you answer that question?
Well, I'm not sure I could speak to that one, but excuse me. But I could speak to the issue of African-American and minority communities because historically, of course, African-Americans could not get home loans. And this is what we called redlining. This was the era where if you lived in a certain neighborhood, you couldn't have access to home mortgages. And that was policy. And then we get into the 90s and the 2000s, and we deregulate mortgages, and then those communities are flooded with mortgage money, yet at a much higher cost. And this is what some of us call greenlining. In other words, you could all of a sudden get a mortgage, but you're paying a much higher interest rate. You're having a predatory loan, some loan with a risky loan product. So certainly a lot of...
I'm African-American, and I'm very aware of those predatory practices, not only with respect to mortgages, but bank lending, insurance, to get homeowners insurance. So I understand the racial undercurrents here. My question is, what about Freddie Mae and Freddie Mac, the Community Reinvestment Act? What role, if any, did they contribute in their practices to this housing crisis?
Well, Community Reinvestment Act has been blamed for a lot of this, but that's not accurate. Community Reinvestment Act applies to what we call depository institutions. Those are banks that we normally think about where we have checking or savings accounts. But 80 to 90% of all the subprime loans are made by non-depository institutions where CRA doesn't actually apply to them. So CRA is not at fault there. CRA says you have to lend money in the communities where you take deposits. It doesn't say you have to make loans that people can't pay or anything like that at all. So I can't really speak to Fannie and Freddie. They come in late to the crisis and do insure quite a bit of bad loans. But the driver of this is the securitization and the large amount of money that is coming from Wall Street. Basically, what happens is mortgage people are told, find us more borrowers. This is fueled by the profitability of securities and then the push to find more people to sign up to make these loans so they can be bundled and sold in the securities market.
So the major culprits here is how we let the deregulated shadow markets go unchecked and lead us to this debacle. Is that pretty much an accurate statement?
That's a big part of it. Yeah, I mean, it might be better to not have so much profit made from people failing in being able to keep their housing.
Well, thank you, Professor.
All right, thank you for the call. Let's continue. We'll go to someone here in Champaign County. This is line two. Hello.
A previous caller brought up part of what I wanted to talk about, the three points that he made, and the one about Freddie Mae and Freddie Mac. An earlier guest, and perhaps the host remembers who it was, pointed out that Freddie Mac and those two entities did not originate any of these subprime loans at all. They were barred from doing it. They had to go to the Congress to get special permission to buy the sliced and diced mortgage units, whatever they call it. So they went with the giddy market, basically, but they were not originating any of these subprime loans at all. So they really can't be put down as a cause. And the fact that the blaming the victim thing continues to be used is I think has a lot to do with race. But we have this ambiguity about title that was referred to earlier. This is in the context of this bill that was just passed, and that Obama has announced that they've announced that they're going to pocket veto it. And this has to do with notarized documents, et cetera. Has to do with making it would have actually made it harder for these people who are aggrieved right now, who are finding these robo-signers sort of phenomena, we're not getting a fair hearing. This would have made it. The fact that he's pocket vetoing and not announcing it, you know, sort of underlines the question: why was this thing passed to begin with? And it's because the banks own the Congress, I guess one might say. I wanted you to respond to that, but also you mentioned the parity, the fact that housing, more affordable housing, is being torn down. You said 30 years, but it seems to me, I remember that it was during the Clinton administration that at least of the housing stock that was government initiated and owned generally, there was always a rule that there had to be, for every unit you had to take down, you had to put up another one. And that was during the Clinton administration that was gotten rid of, and that has actually exacerbated it quite a bit. This is in the context of the Obama administration also having as their general policy sort of a market solution for low-cost housing, and that they actually, their intentions are to try to sell off a lot of the public housing stock that does exist rather than increasing it and improving it in a way that would be would put something underneath the so-called market solution for housing, it seems to me. That's a little inchoate, but I wanted you to respond to some of those points. Thank
okay.
you.
Yeah.
Well, during the Clinton era, I think there's a broad consensus amongst Democrats and Republicans that what we ought to do with public housing is to demolish it and give people housing vouchers to get housing on the open market. And I think that is when the one-for-one replacement rule is eliminated. And that then facilitates programs such as HOPE 6, where now all the public housing high-rises, for example, in Chicago were demolished and people vouchered out, and mixed-income redevelopments put in place. And I'm not arguing that public housing as it was constituted in Chicago met my criteria for adequate housing in terms of its safety. And there's some really interesting history to read on that one. But I would say that it did result in a net loss of low-income units, because in mixed-income housing, you only have 20% or 25% of low-income people. So there's been a substantial net loss of low-income units. Yes.
Yeah. Well, that I guess it that gets to the, I'm sure, the criticism people have made and still make about the way that we've approached public housing is that what it does, in effect, it continues to enforce segregation, and that if we could find some way to get around that, rather than continuing with whatever we do to have big concentrations of low-income folks, that there ought to be some better way to do it. But there seem to be all kinds of reasons why the more enlightened approach somehow just doesn't work.
Well, I think there's two pieces. I think that you ought to allow people to have housing mobility, live where they want. But also I think people ought to have a right to stay in their own communities. And we have focused entirely on deconcentration, i.e. moving people out of their pre-existing communities as a solution. And I think that people ought to have a right to stay. And the model I always use is kind of a sports stadium thing, is we did admit in court, the U.S. government admitted in court, that they purposely discriminated against people and in the location of public housing. And their solution was to demolish it without having any replacement housing available, but actually giving people vouchers. And, when a football team gets a new stadium built, they don't play in the streets for 5 years while they build a new stadium, right? They build that new stadium and they move right out into their brand new stadium. And so wouldn't have much of an argument against demolishing public housing if we would construct new housing for people who we admitted we wronged and had a place for them to go when we tear their housing down. And so that's kind of my take on it, actually.
Mm-hmm. To Urbana, another caller. Line one. Hello.
Is it my turn?
Yes.
Would you please explain a subprime loan?
Yeah, subprime loan is a loan that had a higher interest rate than so-called prime mortgages, and may often have features such as an adjustable rate, interest rate, or something like that as part of the loan. It also usually has much higher fees and costs at the time that the borrower obtains the loan. So the argument that the subprime industry made was, we're making these loans cost more because the folks we lend to are higher risk. So that's their argument in favor of it. The critique of that is that what was happening is that particular communities were being targeted with this subprime loan product. And many of those people would probably qualify for a lower cost loan product.
Well, it sounds strange when you say sub, and then everything costs more.
Yeah, that's
the higher price. prime loan.
That's true. There's an awful lot of jargon in this area of work, and it's a very complex web as you try to trace it. It really traces from our homes and our neighborhoods all the way up into global financial markets.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus, and we're talking with Jeff Crump. He is an associate professor in the Housing Studies program at the University of Minnesota in their College of Design. He does work in affordable housing, housing policy, urban politics. He's visiting the campus. We'll give a talk on these very issues today as part of the Friday Forum at the University. Why? It's open to the public and free, and if you'd like to hear him speak, you can certainly do that. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You talked a little bit earlier about how going back a number of years now, like 8 years or more, in your research, you were looking at what was happening in low-income neighborhoods in Minneapolis, St. Paul, found that there were this was a place where there were high concentrations of subprime loans, and where you also were finding, going back to the early 2000s, also very high levels of foreclosures before the point that it was capturing the attention of the country. And also you talked about the fact that you would talk about your research and people would boo and they'd say, oh, you know, that was when we were still saying, but home ownership is really the thing, and we need to be promoting this, and we need to be making it affordable for low-income people. And you were saying, but now look here. Look what's going on. So then what happened was then when it spread out and when it started to affect the suburbs and started to affect more middle class and upper middle class people, then it started to capture the attention of the nation. So just how, when you talk about the spread, how far has the spread been, and is that just something that's going to continue to spread further?
Well, I think what happens, of course, is that it starts out as a story where subprime lenders target minority communities, but it mm-hmm. gets much bigger than that. And it's also that there's a lot of mortgages that we classify as prime mortgages that are very risky mortgages. For example, Alt-A mortgages, a relatively high percentage of the prime market. No documentation loans, where people don't have to document their income or employment. And these even get more extreme. We have loans that were called NINA loans, no income, no asset loans. And so these originated widely. And part of what happens is the original subprime mortgage crisis causes a broader economic recession where there's large numbers of jobs that are being lost and people are unable to make their mortgages. So there's kind of a triggering effect. And now, yes, foreclosure rates are increasing in the suburbs and even in rural areas. And there were relatively surprisingly large proportions of subprime loans in those areas, along with these other risky mortgage products. And so what this is really calling into question, I think, is suburban middle class home ownership and the future of that. And the question is, are we going to do something to help folks out, or are we just going to let housing prices keep falling until they reach some sort of currently unknown bottom? And mm-hmm. I don't think there's a policy answer to that coming out of Washington as of yet.
Mm-hmm. Back to the phones. Line one, Champagne. Hello.
Yes, I was actually just thinking about the middle class. That's why I called in. My husband and I bought a house in 2004, and now we just sold and bought in 2010. And we were shocked to see we got the same advice at the height of this, you know, in 2004 when there was crazy rates. You know, we were told again that we should buy a home at least $200,000 more than we were comfortable buying. So it seems like bankers haven't really changed their advice in this. And further, I remember in 2004 when we were going to buy, reading a piece by Alan Greenspan in this Time magazine, you know, where your average person might get economic advice. And he said that any new homeowner would be crazy not to get an ARM mortgage. I feel really grateful that both times we didn't. We underbought what we were told to buy, and last minute, last time, we didn't get the ARM. But it seems like it would be very easy for a middle-class person to be misled and end up in these really terrible situations.
Yeah, I mean, subsequently, Alan Greenspan does admit that there's a flaw in his worldview, which cost homeowners their homes in many cases.
Yes, he came out and said he didn't realize these institutions would be so greedy after expressing sort of the on-rand approach for all those years. So I just wonder, is anyone in Washington going to say it wasn't purely homeowners' fault, you know?
That's a good question. Yeah, I don't have an answer for that one because the financial industry is very influential, and there's strong links between academic economics and the financial industry, very lucrative links. There's a recent article put out by the Chronicle of Higher Education on Larry Summers that would be interesting for you to read to kind of get a picture of the links between academics and the financial industry, too.
I'll definitely have to read that. I just wanted to call and comment because people had mentioned mortgages of 16 and 20 years ago, and I'll say they're still telling middle-class people to buy too big a home, I think.
Well, thanks for the comment. I appreciate it. And I guess it again, makes me think about something, and we talked about on this a little earlier, that there was for such a long time this pervasive attitude. Everybody had the attitude, individuals and government and people in the lending industry and people in the realty industry. I think almost everybody had this attitude that there was this given, that the value of real property would only and always go up, and that you could always rely on whatever you bought today, you're being able to sell it in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, and get more than you paid for it. And obviously, it seems that we haven't completely let go of that idea.
No, we haven't. I mean, you know, kind of where we're at is the old model has failed in many respects. Mm-hmm. Our old model of housing policy is not providing adequate and affordable housing for people. But we don't know what's going to replace it. And so subsequently, part of that is that we're still following the old model and hoping that we'll reinvigorate the housing market by convincing people to buy homes. Mm-hmm. People are always asking me, are we at the bottom yet? And you know, that's not my purview to give people advice on whether we're at the bottom or not. So I think that there's kind of a vacuum in where we're trying to figure out where we're going to go from here. And I don't think we have a roadmap right now.
Yeah. To Spring Bay for another caller, line four. Hello.
Good morning. I'll try to be brief. First of all, I don't think we're at the bottom, but have you done any research on the effect of Section 8 housing vouchers, rent vouchers, and school busing on the deterioration of older neighborhoods and inner-city neighborhoods with the kind of forcing white flight, the push-pull effect?
Well, that's...
You know what I'm getting at here?
I understand what you're getting at, but that's not actually what happens. Of course, the neighborhoods deteriorate because they're unable to obtain mortgage capital. They're the oldest housing in the first place, and they can't get capital to either buy or repair homes, yeah. But that's not my area of specialty.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll keep listening.
All right, thank you. We have just a couple of minutes left. Someone wants to call real quick. I'm sure that we can get in the call and the time remains. I guess I find myself again going back to we have touched on this a couple of times, but I guess I find myself again going back to the idea to the question of the future of home ownership, since that has been such a long cherished idea that's highly desirable. It's a great thing. It's one of the things that we work toward. It's one of the things that shows that you're established, you know, you're in the equity stream. Are we really losing that? Or can we somehow rethink it so that we can still have that be a possibility, but that we're going to have to scale. People are going to have to scale back on their expectations. They can't be thinking about their homes as investment vehicles, and there and obviously there has to be a lot more oversight of lending. We just can't say lenders can come up with any kind of wacky plan that they want, and then we just have to say let the buyer beware.
I think our most immediate problem with respect to that is what to do about people who are underwater on their home mortgages right now. Mm-hmm. If we don't slow down or stop foreclosure, then values are going to continue to go down. There's estimates out there that it would cost between $50 to $60 billion to refinance most of the borrowers who are in that position. And we did provide money to the financial industry to keep them afloat. So, you know, what are we going to do about underwater homeowners? We promote homeownership for the last 50 years to everybody, as you've mentioned, Dave. So now that we have a problem, are we just going to let them sink? Or I would think that we ought to do something to try to refinance people, get them out from being underwater on their homes. And I know there'd be a lot of debate about that, but bear in mind that anytime someone goes into foreclosure, it doesn't just affect them, it affects everybody else. It causes price declines for nearby homes, it results in a deteriorated neighborhood, and it also results in a family losing their shelter. And so it might actually be a good investment over the long term to seriously refinance people and help them survive in their homes. And this was what was done during the Great Depression.
Hmm. We're at the point we're going to have to stop here, and I'm sure that we'll come back to many of these questions in future programs. But for the moment there, we're going to have to stop. I do, though, again, want to mention that our guest, Jeff Crump from University of Minnesota, is visiting the campus and will be giving a talk as part of the Friday Forum series at noon at the University Y on South Wright. These programs are all open to the public, and so it's free. If you would like to hear more from him on the subject, you should stop by. And our guest is Associate Professor in the Housing Studies Program. That's in Department of Design, Housing, and Apparel at University of Minnesota in the College of Design. And thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.